Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I am John McKenzie and I'm joined, as I always am, by my good friend and producer, Mike Zimmerman. Mike, how are you doing?
It's good to be back, John. Excited to dive into this week's episode.
Yep, me too, because I'm very excited about this week's episode because I was lucky enough to have an hour-long conversation with a German tactical expert, Martin Raffelt, who is one of the Spiel Verlagerung set. We had a long conversation about the concept of patience in football tactics, which I think is a very interesting topic on the basis of a series of tweets that Martin put out. Mike, you've just listened to the conversation. What did you make of it?
Well, I don't know about you, John, but in general, I'm not really a patient person, but Martin settled me down a bit and really helped me see the balance of playing with patience and playing with a bit of risk, you know, specifically the role of Joshua Kimmich at Bayern. And for me, the biggest takeaway from this episode is to always remember that football is a game, right? There are always two sides to these conversations. Both sides are trying to win, and it's really not always a case of doing X gets you a result of Y.
Yeah, and it's a really fun conversation because I think it just breaks down a lot of what's going on in modern tactical theory and where things might go next as well. So as always, I will say the listeners don't want to hear us speaking. They want to hear our guests speaking. So let's go over and listen to what Martin Raffelt has to say about patience and positional play. Martin Raffelt, thank you so much for coming on today. It's great to have you on the podcast. Not before time. It's we should have had you on much earlier, but thank you so much for coming on today.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation. Happy to be here.
I think the best place for us to start is to let our listeners know a little bit about you, a bit about your background and what it is that you're up to. So, yeah, can you tell us how it is that you ended up covering football tactics and your experience of the game itself?
How did I end up there? Well, the key moment is probably me joining Spielverlagerung.de tactic blog in 2011. I was pretty young back then. Before I was like looking into the game, I was interested in the tactical side of the game, which was not well covered back then. So I figured out like I'll do my own stuff. Like it was a little bit like we had in English, there was zonal marking. In German, there was sort of nothing. So I felt like, okay, it's not there in German, so I'll do it myself. So I had an own private podcast where I tried to analyze things a little bit and got in touch with other Spielverlagerung guys. And we did this podcast and podcast blog. And from this blog, things started to go anywhere. Yeah.
And you have worked for clubs as well, right?
Yeah, I was working for Hajduk Split, one of the biggest clubs in Croatia for 3 years. I was assistant coach of the under 19 first, then the second team, which is like second league in Croatia, and like you could call it like heads of tactics for the academy if you want. They reached the youth league finals actually last year. I'm not there anymore, but obviously I still take all the credits for that for that success.
So, yeah. And let's talk a little bit about Spiel Verlagerung as well, because a lot of the original guys are now working in clubs and have mm-hmm. made that step from maybe doing a little bit more of the theoretical work into the practical side of things. Obviously, the poster boy is René. But in terms of that process of moving from doing a lot of the theory work into working at clubs, how important was that for you in particular?
The theoretical work or the move?
The move, I think. I guess that making those theories practical.
Yeah, it was very important. When I first started coaching was when I was like doing writing about football for already 3 or 4 years or something like that. And like very quickly, I realized I should have done that step earlier because like I felt I want to be ready when I actually start working. And when I was working, I realized, okay, you cannot be ready without doing the actual work. So just work and practice helps you so much more, because you have so much more things to think about than what you see from the outside, basically. Mm-hmm. When you like analyzing the game is one thing, but analyzing how things get on the pitch basically is a whole other topic. So especially in my first 2 years when I did the like youth coaching on amateur level, I learned so many things. This was a big expansion of perspective.
Sure. And would you say that has changed your perception of the use of tactics? For example, I know René Maric likes to talk about the fact that tactics don't exist, and that it seems as though there's been a definite shift there from saying, you know, the theoretical without the practical is nothing. So the practical always takes primacy in that sense. So would you say that has changed your view? Would you say you view tactics differently now, having worked in the game, than you did before?
I mean, it's almost 10 years ago before I started that, so I cannot exactly say how my point of view back then was, but it surely was a big shift. It was a big shift. It was not that I, like, it was not so much that I had before some convictions that I had to scrap, but it was more that there was, like, so many other things coming into play as well. So it was, as I said before, it was more like an expansion rather than a restructuring of how I was thinking. I think it's like, the thing is that if you analyze the game, you don't know how much effort behind every aspect of the game is there. So for example, what's one thing that like takes quite a lot of effort, but like everybody's doing this effort, so you never really see how it looks like if you don't do that effort, is like basic defending things. Like if you not work with the team on really basic defense, then what will happen is that, like, especially on younger levels on under 15 and such, that like opponent hits a long ball and you can see the goal and that's it. Mm-hmm. And the game is over. And this is something that you will never see, or very, very rarely see in the Premier League, only in very specific circumstances. And you need to, because people work on that and people put the effort and people have functioning backlines, right? And this is something you don't get in the case where you would analyze that, because you never see it not working. Sure. And this is something that you learn and practice quite quickly.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, let's move, having said that, into talking about some of the theoretical aspects of the game, in particular the modern evolution, things that are happening right now, because you wrote a really interesting thread recently, which I would recommend people go and read if they're listening to this and they haven't read that thread before. But the thread is, in your own words, about Bayern and the general issue of impatience in positional play under the mental pressure of being forced to win. Now, there's lots of already concepts here that are very complex, so let's start teasing those things out a little bit. So firstly, just so we're clear, let's talk to our listeners about what you're meaning by positional play, which I know it's an incredibly broad question, and I think, you know, there has been a huge amount of evolution in recent years. So maybe the best way for us to do this is to start out by just giving a general summary of what you mean by positional play, and then we can move on to clarify where you think positional play is in particular right now. So let's start with that first issue. What is positional play?
It's a little bit difficult where to draw the line there, and I was thinking, you sent me this question before, and I was thinking, like, it's funny that we use this term, because it sort of says that we are using positions to attack in some way, and positions were there before there was positional play, right? So the game was always positional, if you want. So this is a little bit strange, but I think I would phrase it like that. Positional play is trying to occupy all of the pitch or most of the pitch to progress through positional advantages. So you want on some spot on the pitch, you want to have a positional advantage over the opponent. So it's not like when you're one against two, when you have one player against two opponents, this is a positional disadvantage for you. So you in positional play, you don't want to have that. You will avoid that, and you want to have Optimally, you want to have a free player. You want to find a free player, or at least you want to have numerical superiority, or maybe numerical, like no numerical disadvantage, so you can at least attack one against three against three, something like that. Something like that. So using positional advantages for attacking, I would say.
Yeah, so I guess if we had one player with the ball and one player without the ball who's trying to win the ball back, the way you get around that player is by dribbling around them, having the skill superiority to get around them. And what positional play is suggesting is, why not use the positions of our players to actually remove that scenario, make it much easier for you to pass around an opponent player. And I think the sort of classic example of what people have used in the past to talk about positional play has been, dividing the pitch into channels or areas, and saying that what positional teams or coaches who coach positional play are trying to do is fill those channels. But I think that's quite a rudimentary and old-fashioned way of talking about it now. Would you agree with that positional play isn't just about thinking in terms of channels and filling channels, but there's a lot more that goes into it?
Yeah, I think I would say this is sort of the starting point. Like this is where you start, that you occupy the space on the pitch. So you have all the space available and you can play everywhere on the pitch. So the opponent also has to defend everywhere, sort of. And if they don't defend something on the pitch, we play there. So if we want to be able to do that, we need to occupy the whole pitch, sort of.
Mm-hmm. And so moving now into the present day, where would you say that positional play is at right now? What would you say the general ideas that coaches are trying to use to get those positional advantages, as you call them, where they're coming from?
I think first of all, I might say that I think the main reason why positional play is good and successful is that it allows you to have a stable way to stop attacks, play back, and circulate and rebuild the attack. This is something when you look at all the football and when you look at teams who have no, where you would say they don't play positional football, or they play very bad positional play, they don't have that. And this alone gives you a big advantage, A, for the attack, but B, also for the defense when you lose the ball. So I think this is the base for decent modern football, I think. And I think right now, like not everybody, but almost everybody in the like top level football world is picking this up and is applying it. So I think we had a phase of, let's say, 15 years where this came from, it's something new and it makes a difference, to something that is a standard and everybody's doing it. So I think right now we're at a point where this is sort of the standard and everybody's doing it. And what the coaches are trying now is to find within this framework like further advantages. How can we do this even better, or what's the best way to apply it? What positions do we want to have? How many players do we need at the back to be protected against counterattacks? How many players do we want at the wing? Do we want to play more from the wingers? Do we want to play more through the middle? Do we want to play more in between the lines? What's the best thing and how we get there? What structures will help us? So I think many coaches are going in different directions in the details of that.
It sounds as though a big part then of what modern positional play is about control. And I know control is a very loaded term. And I, for example, Mikel Arteta says he doesn't like the term. He likes the concept of dominance. But this is, you've mentioned a few areas there. It's not just about moving the ball through lines of pressure, which is maybe where it started out. But there's a defensive element here as well. It's about, okay, when we lose the ball, are our players positioned in the best way to be able to defend those turnovers? And again, if you're doing something like the really top elite teams, I'm thinking Manchester City and Arsenal right now, often what they're trying to do is defend with the ball in the opposition's third, keeping the ball as long as possible. There's always the possibility that you can lose the ball, face a counterattack, and that is the way that Manchester City, for example, tend to concede their goals. So this is a lot about not just about moving balls through lines of pressure now in an attacking sense, but it's about being able to control the ball in every phase of play, right?
Yeah, I think that's not something new, I would say. I would say this was there from the start. There was like, wasn't it even Cruyff who said this about Pep's Barcelona, that the most impressive thing is their counter-pressing, actually, and not their passing? And also back then, even like after first or second season of Guardiola at Barcelona, Klopp at Dortmund was already talking about this and tried to copy some elements and such. Like, I think this is a lesser known part of Klopp's coaching career, is that after he won the title with Dortmund, he went in the second season, he started with a big possession play revolution. Like, he was, okay, we play positional, we drop back the six, we have 70% of possession and we get even better. And he sort of failed with that and got back to like a more defensively oriented approach, and then like build it step by step from there with Ilkay Gundogan as a key figure. I think this is an interesting thing in this context. One thing I want to add for in terms of control versus dominance is that this is, I think, really a key point for the positional play debate, because what you, like, Arteta's right, what you want is dominance, but what you get very often is control. But you get if you have control over everything in the game, you will control the game to score. So if you had ultimate control of the game, you win 20-0. And this is not happening. What we are having when we are talking about control is control over the 0-0. We decide if we keep the game at 0-0 or if we try something out of that, if we break out of a 0-0 space, basically. And this is what control gives you in practice. If you have control, you just beat everybody and nobody is able to achieve that.
Sure. And I think that's where we're going to end up talking about where the evolution of the modern game is going, because I think we're moving away from that particularly Cruyffian Pep Guardiolan idea of control to introduce new ideas of how you can control the game, and in ways that maybe don't rely on you having to squeeze the opposition into their final third, break down low blocks the whole time. So that's what your thread is all about. So let's start getting into that. So the thread starts off with an exploration of the contradiction between what you call a winning mentality and positional play, which, as I read it, is what makes a lot of footballers great, is their desire to change matches, but that this can have a negative impact on a positional play approach. So can you explain to us what that contradiction is that you're talking about in this thread?
Well, to put it short, is that in positional play, you wait for a certain moment to play forward and to find a certain player in a certain space. And like, Messi is not, when you look at Barcelona with Messi, Messi didn't get the ball every time, every attack. He was not omnipresent. It was just, he got the ball in the right moment, in the right space, and from there he was maximum effective. And he was able to wait for this moment to appear. But if you have the desire, if you are in a difficult spot in the game and you have the desire to change the outcome, you might not want to wait for this moment. You are limited on time in the second half. You are very limited on time. And the more pressure you have in yourself, the more you might feel under a time pressure where you need to do something quickly. And you cannot wait for the right moment to appear, but you have to force something. And when you want to force something, positional play doesn't give you that many tools, because many things that you do in positional play is based on the opponent. The opponent leaves that player free, we play to that player. The opponent leaves that player free, we play to that player. And then, like, one of the main ideas of Guardiola is also, like, we circulate until the opponent makes a mistake, and then we exploit this mistake. But what if the opponent doesn't make a mistake? What then? Then you circulate forever and you do nothing. So this is a bit tricky.
Mm-hmm. And the player that you mention in this regard is, we're talking about Bayern Munich, of course, is Joshua Kimmich. How much would you say that the problems that Bayern have faced this season under Thomas Tuchel have been down to this inability to be patient enough to wait for those openings to come?
I think the main problem for Bayern is that Leverkusen is so good. I think the most part of the season was comparable to the seasons before. And if Leverkusen wasn't that great and wouldn't score so much points, then they probably wouldn't even have the problem, and they wouldn't have these problems with the impatience. I think Leverkusen actively makes Bayern worse by putting them under pressure and force them to force things at times. Or at least it feels like that for Bayern, I think. And I think, like, most prob like the fact that Bayern is only on level with Leverkusen and not ahead of them is not so much about many problems that they had, maybe here and there a little bit, but it was visible in the last weeks and months, especially in the game against Leverkusen, that Bayern was not in the same comfortable spot where they would usually be, where they would be happy to wait for a right moment and to attack. And also, I think an issue which also appears there is that usually, like, Bayern was always a relatively direct, like, they were positional, but relatively direct in that positional play. And Tuchel puts a little more sense of security into them. So Tuchel's interpretation of positional play requires a little bit more patience than Bayern usually has. So I think this also comes into play there. And then you had a couple of games, a couple of periods within games where you could see that Bayern suddenly stopped to play what you would know them for, and they started to become actually bad. Like, they had a decent start in that game against Leverkusen, and then they crumbled more and more against Leverkusen, which was in that game mostly defending. Leverkusen was not very dominant, right? Leverkusen was relatively defensive, and Bayern had not the patience to correctly play against this very, very passive approach.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I haven't put this on the running order, but it might be interesting while we're on the topic of Bayern to talk about Julian Nagelsmann, because Julian Nagelsmann has two seasons at the club. In the first season, he's doing a lot of the more positional ideas, or the more patient positional ideas. And then in the second season, we start seeing maybe a little bit more of injection of pace into what Bayern are doing. Why do you think that it went wrong for him, given that he was trying to overcome some of these problems that we're talking about in terms of having to have patience all the time?
Well, I think Nagelsmann is a very impatient coach. I think he's trying to create a positional play which is not based on patience, where you can basically attack all the time and you create chances all the time. And he puts priority of chance creation over priority of protecting yourself against counterattacks, which Guardiola and Arteta are not doing, for example, and Tuchel is also not doing. So these three coaches are clearly, we always want to be protected against counterattacks, and then we try to create chances from there. And Nagelsmann sometimes steps over the line and says, we don't care so much for protection against counterattacks. We want to create chances all the time. And he puts more players forward for that. And I think this makes your team less stable and less consistent, but more dangerous. And I think Nagelsmann conceded relatively many goals last season, and this was probably the main thing. In the moment where you don't score your chances, or where your opponent is able to like block you at their box or something, and you don't get to your chances, then they suddenly have counterattacks, and instead of like 0-0ing a very boring game, you're suddenly losing 2-0, because it's not only that they can defend you, they also get counterattacks, which team gets counterattacks against Man City and Arsenal? It's not many teams, more teams are going to get counterattacks against Nagelsmann teams, and then like naturally you are a little bit less consistent in your output. Mm-hmm. Even though you might be even better maybe in your peak because you're creating more, but I think it's quite natural that you're becoming less consistent.
Yeah, I guess you have to rely on scoring your goals and the opponent not scoring their goals more than these other coaches that you're talking about.
Yep.
One final thing on Bayern, because one of the things that you talked about with things going wrong for Bayern actually wasn't the in-possession stuff, but the out-of-possession moment. So we've already talked a little bit about the importance of positional play on your out-of-possession phase. With Bayern, you were talking about the players jumping in out of possession and leaving themselves exposed. So, yeah, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on the impact of patience then in the out-of-possession aspects of positional play.
Yeah, I think there are just... As we discussed right now, one of the main things that Arteta and Guardiola get from positional play, and Tuchel as well, is that they are extremely stable teams. It's very difficult to hurt them and to create chances against them. The same applies for Leverkusen right now, by the way. And this is partially because they have a lot of the ball, so that the opponent just gets less attacking opportunities. Then many of these attacking opportunities are from deep inside their half against an opponent which is very well structured to stop this counterattack. So it's very difficult to get out of your half. It's very difficult to even get the ball. And then hopefully, in the best cases, you also have teams which are defending very well. So what was special, I think, for Guardiola's team, especially last season when they finally won the Champions League, is that they were also a very good defensive team. If they were just forced to defend their own box, they would do it very well with tons of center backs there. This is sort of based on patience in right moments, because in defense you always have to make the decision, do I go for recovering the ball or do I need to drop back in order to stop that, or like stay passive in order to not let them break me? And you want to go for the ball in the right moment, and you want to drop back in the right moment or stay passive in the right moment. And this right moment is something like this, this assessment: can I go for ball recovery here, or do I need to stay passive? This is something that every player in defending does intuitively, every time, but basically in every defensive situation. And obviously, when you are impatient, and when you in your mind is, we need to force something, we need to win the game, we need to get the ball back immediately so we can attack again, or also like, oh, the opponent has the ball, And your thought is not, we need to get back and stop them from scoring, but your thought is, it's a problem that they even have the ball. They shouldn't even have this attack because it already makes us look bad. In these circumstances, you will always have a tendency, a bias, to go into recovering the ball and not stepping back. And also, you might what was visible at Bayern in a couple of situations, and also with Dortmund in the last seasons a lot, was that you get into situations where you fail to win the ball, and like not only the player who goes for the ball is impatient and like too focused on winning the ball, but also the players behind him and around him who also are thinking like, this guy needs to win the ball now so then we can attack again. And so they don't track back enough, so they leave certain players running because they are not thinking, ah, we need to stop this attack. They think we should win the ball and attack ourselves again. So also like this balance in transitioning becomes different.
So the players are counter pressing in moments when they should be passive, essentially, and misreading those situations. You end this part of the thread with a really interesting couple of tweets. I will read out bits from it, but you're basically saying the thing is, it's actually good defensive behavior to defend as aggressively as possible, but only until you're outplayed, which is what you're talking about there. And you're saying that this makes the solving the problem much harder than it might seem, because we might want players to step on the gas, to dig in more, to apply more pressure, but how do we prevent them from overdoing it, from wanting it too much? So I'm interested here whether or not you think one of the downsides of positional play is that in fact, the modern game is moving in the opposite direction, which is towards intensity and physicality and athleticism. I suppose that all of those concepts are almost endemically opposed to this idea of having patience, particularly in defensive moments.
Yeah, that's something that is very interesting. Actually, it's a big task in coaching to get these two things together, because like in defense you want to be as aggressive as possible, and in attack you then want to be as calm as possible. And this like calm, patient decision making and super explosive, aggressive defending, this is two very, very different mind states, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not easy to get this into one team. It's probably like one of the most impressive things that Arteta and Guardiola and also Klopp are doing, that they get this together quite well.
Mm-hmm. I would like to for us to quickly return to Jurgen Klopp, because I think this is quite interesting, because you've already alluded to the fact that Klopp, when he was at Dortmund, did move into a more positional phase, which he described as going wrong. And I am aware that you are the guy who's written the book on Jurgen Klopp, so I hope this question isn't too reductive, but the general narrative for Klopp in the Premier League is that he arrives in the Premier League and tries to implement gegenpressing play, and in the first few seasons realises that he cannot simply gegenpress his way to a Premier League title, so has to introduce elements of control more and more. But it feels to me now, 7 or 8 years later, that what we're seeing from Jurgen Klopp is a return to that intensity in a way that feels a lot more direct maybe than it did at middle periods when he was at Liverpool. And I wondered whether or not you think that is, again, indicative that we're finding ways of opposing the patience that positional play requires, that you can get upside if you can attack directly in certain ways as well.
Good question. I'm not sure. Like, I think they had it with their focus on the wing and crosses. They had a quite decent setup to not, like, they needed to be too patient, because if they are in doubt, they can just play a ball into the box or deep or like find Salah and try something. So I think their style was also not that much based on patience, but obviously also to some degree. I also think it's not something that Klopp developed in England, but he developed it before already in the years. Mm-hmm. And I think he's always just fine-tuning and finding a new thing there, finding a new thing there. I think many things that he does are not philosophical evolutions, but it's more just trying to find the best setup for a certain set of players, and it's more like fine tuning and details what he's changing. I don't think there's a big philosophical twist, like shift, not a big philosophical shift anymore. Mm-hmm. for him happening. I would think. I'm not like completely sure about it. Maybe he thought before the season, okay, we need to look more at the defensive side again. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just that like the seasons before, he came into the season as like the number one contender of City, and this season he comes into the season as like, let's see what Liverpool can do. They had a big big break. They switched a lot of players, so let's see how good they are. So maybe naturally teams are trying a little bit more against them, and they are just not facing so many teams, waiting and just let them play. Maybe that might be a factor, but it's difficult to answer conclusively, I think.
I love the way of thinking about the evolution of coaches, not in that big picture sense of like philosophical shifts where they're trying to determine where the next move is going to come, but as the result of lots of micro evolutions through the course of seasons and pre-seasons where they are faced with real problems that they have to fix, and through the course of those micro evolutions they end up with big evolutionary phases, but not because they're sitting there as oracles surveying football and saying, what's going on, how can we anticipate the next shift?
It's sort of both, I think, right? I think both sure things are happening. Both things are quite exciting, yeah.
Yeah, of course. At this point in the thread, you go on to talk a little bit more about how winning mentality in the modern game is much more to do with confidence and composure than it is with willpower, which I suppose it's what touches on what we've already been talking about here. But what I found really interesting about this section of your thread is that the team that you talked about when it comes to confidence and composure was Real Madrid. Now, Real Madrid aren't a team who are generally associated with positional ideas. So I guess this means that the concept of patience that we're talking about goes well beyond the realms of just positional play then. It's an important aspect of all tactical approaches.
Yeah, it's generally just like how to deal with pressure. Obviously, when there's a lot of pressure, especially in important games, and when you're good with dealing with pressure, and Real Madrid is very good with dealing with pressure, then this helps you. And also, it generally gives you an advantage in terms of sticking to a certain thing and not trying to on the fly come up with better solutions. Like it's relatively it's a little bit strange for Real because they're sort of coming up with new solutions on the fly all the time because that's just their nature. But in especially when you're playing in the Guardiola team, the solutions that you have on your hand and that you are searching for all the time, they are so good that if you think like, it's not working, we need to find something better, and you try to come up with it on the fly, it's very difficult to find something which is actually better, especially as the rest of the team is not in your head. They don't have the same idea, right? You're trying it on your own. And so it's better when you're just confident enough in your play style that you stick to your play style. And even if it doesn't work perfectly, you still try to do it as much as possible and as good as possible. And you hope like, okay, we don't have a plan to 4-0 the opponent and go home, but our plan is still good enough that we can compete. And if we need, with this plan that we have, we need to find the 1-0 or the 2-1, and that's fine as well. To have this sort of patience is also important, to not just change your playstyle. Like whatever your playstyle is, if you change your playstyle on the fly, it's very often bad. It's not probably not always bad, but it's very often bad.
Mm-hmm. I've got a tongue-in-cheek question here, which is, given that Real Madrid are set up to have, you know, Galacticos players, the best talented players in the world. In part, you've talked about how what makes those players great is the ability to make decisions in moments. Do you think that, given that they have that confidence and composure, they would be well suited if Real Madrid ever brought a positional play coach in?
Yeah, sure. I think so. I think it would be no problem. They probably would like adapt this in a week and had no problem to execute it. The question is more if they want to do it or if they might feel in certain moments that it's worse for them than what they are doing already. Because like if you tell Modric like, don't drop to the right side, just stay in the center, we want you in this position, he might be like, I'm moving around where I want for my whole life and I was pretty successful with that. Are you sure what you are doing is better? so this might be the issue, that they don't trust this approach. And it's also I'm not sure if it's like what you do with positional as a positional coach is you try to give them structures or you try to implement a system which consistently finds very good structures. And Real, especially with Benzema and Modric, especially those two guys, they are really good in like finding structures on their own. Like it's not only that they find solutions and they're good with the ball, but also the way they're moving, knowing when to go wide, knowing when to drop back, knowing when to move forward. They're so good in that stopping them from doing it might like hurt them a lot, and it might not lead to the team actually finding better structures. But Real has moments in their games where they have very questionable structures, so it might also help them a lot in other moments.
Sure. And obviously Benzema has gone. Modric is not going to play forever, even though he gives the impression that he is. Do you think that Real Madrid will struggle in the modern league game if they don't have those players who can and find those structures? Will that prompt them to move closer to a sort of positional model?
Good question. The thing is that they are individually... I generally think like the general narrative is that transitioning, like a defensive approach, is good for individually bad team, and a positional approach is good for an individually good team, because you're used to good team having the ball, bad team defending. This is what you used to see, but I think it's actually the opposite, because in positional play, when you have a very clean positional play, the players have to do very simple things all the time. So even when your players are not so good. I recall Swansea City, for example, who were very successful with individually not so good players applying this. Then, like, they still can do it. And when you play defensive, you are your game is based on transition. And in transition, I think there's a bigger impact of individual quality. So I think another thing that helps Real is that they have relatively transitional-based games. And in these transitional moments, they're individually so good that this is pretty good for them. So if you make them play more possession-based, and you make them less transition-based, perhaps, and this mm-hmm. might actually hurt them because of all the quality they have. Mm-hmm. I think you would need to find a very good balance to still allow for enough transition if possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is what we're going to come on to talk about, because I think we are going to talk about different ways of being able to generate attacking moments within the mm-hmm. positional play framework, which don't rely necessarily on this high control final third possession and finding ways to be transitional still within the context of positional play. But let's move on quickly. So the opposite side of the same coin, you've talked a lot in this thread about how impatience can lead to spiraling form. And once again, you used a team not really known for positional play to talk about this spiraling, which is Jurgen Klopp's Dortmund. So perhaps it's worth teasing out how impatience can be bad for teams who rely on intense counter-pressing and direct attacking as well, because we've not really touched on that as well. And as I said, you're the guy who's written the book on Jurgen Klopp, particularly at his time in Dortmund. So what would you say to that? Why do you think impatience caused problems for Klopp in his final season at Dortmund?
Well, I think they're not known for positional play, but they did positional play. It's okay. Probably just not so well known.
Yeah, sure.
So this was a part of it, but I think the bigger part was actually in defense, that they started to, what I said before, that they start to feel like even when the opponent just has the ball, this is a problem already. And then when Klopp is trying to have a generally very aggressive defensive style, when you are very aggressive already, it becomes pretty easy to become over aggressive, right? But what we talk about is basically over aggressiveness or a little bit under responsible for the other side of attacking, dropping back and protecting the goal. So this in a system which is very pressing based, this can happen earlier, I think, than otherwise, and also mm-hmm. in counter pressing. And specifically that case, it was also a thing that they attacked a little bit too early and too much, and they had a lot of attacking where they were finding a player who could do something, and they were like they were sort of brute forcing their way mm-hmm. into the box, but they were never really outplaying opponents, so the opponent was still always on their feet and putting pressure, and they had a lot of chances where they were able to get into the box and get a shot off, but they were never really breaking behind opponents, and they were giving away a lot of chances because they were under pressure, because there was not big of a shooting angle on the goal, and the chances they created were not so high quality, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think if we look at Erling Haaland this season, it's certainly something that is impacting his finishing. He's he's consistently throughout his career been someone who finishes above his expected goals. And you mentioned in that season for Dortmund's final season that you felt as though there were some crazy expected goals numbers going on there. And you think maybe the fact that they were trying to force things actually impacted things.
It was actually the expected goals numbers back then. I think we're even more crazy than nowadays, because I think nowadays we have a bigger we look at defensive pressure, we look at how many players are in the box. And if you consider this in your expected goal models, it was still like they were still underperforming. But I think back then we didn't have this defensive pressure so well sorted out, and I think back then the models went crazy. Like it looked like the most unlucky run in the history of humankind. It was crazy. But yeah. But nowadays the numbers are just a little bit unlucky.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to michelobultra.com/courtside to learn more.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF-IN-IOWA. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Don't just ride the index, seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
You end the thread with 2 points, sort of two observations. So, and both of them are about the concept of patience. So the first one is about positional play against passive opponents. So opponents who fall into deep blocks. You say the expectations put on teams and players, especially against very passive opponents. With positional play, you have to accept some boring games. You don't blow them away 3-0. Play safely to nil. Score one goal at some point. And these are the archetypal patience games where you have to just keep plugging away. As you've said, it's about recycling the ball, waiting for the opponent to make a mistake, find the free man and break down those low blocks in those moments. And sometimes you may even lose, but more often than not, you're going to win. I'm interested in whether or not you think these moments require more patience. So these moments against low blocks require more patience than other kinds of games for positional play teams.
Yeah, because usually, like you can, in positional play, when the opponent is pressing, you can find moments where you can attack quite quickly. But when the opponent, like, you're always trying to find your free player, right? And when the opponent leaves your number 10 free, and they're trying to put so much pressure that you cannot find your number 10, but then your positional play is so good that you just find your number 10, you have a quick attack on your hand. And if they are just dropping back and they all the time leave your center backs free, they all the time leave your fullbacks free, they never move out, they only protect your front line and your attacking players, then you will never find your attacking players in a position where they are free, and you need to be very patient to move yourself into these positions, and at some point, like, maybe drag the opponent out, force them to do something, or find your attacking player in a small little space or so.
Mm-hmm. And you round off this point with the line, Kimmich has the abilities to be the best holding six in the world. He just doesn't play like it, which I think is a great quote and indicates something about the importance of mentality for players within a tactical system. And I don't mean mentality there in terms of, you know, wanting it more, because as you've pointed out throughout the thread, Kimmich is a player who wants it more. But it's almost like an attitude that certain players are going to have better attitudes for some tactical systems than others.
Yeah, sure. I think so. Right. Also, every player has a natural and intuitive way to play the game based on his personal abilities and assessments, and also the experiences that he made. Mm-hmm. Obviously, when this fits very well to the tactical idea of the team, it will work for them quite well. So, like, you have you have players who are small and slow and technically gifted and creative, and they want to keep the ball at the ground and play around and be creative. And then you have players who are completely fine with giving the ball away, who are kicking it forward, who are running, who are fighting, who are going into duels with completely different abilities. And, like, one of the saddest things is to see one of these players in a team which does the opposite of what they can do. This is like the worst thing that can happen to a player.
Mm-hmm. And the second point that you raise, and I think this is where it starts getting really interesting, it's about the evolution of a modern game away from, not away from positional approaches, but to finding solutions to the problems that you talk about in the first point, which is the easiest thing for opponents to do against teams who are playing positionally, who are dominant, is to sit in that low block and just make it really hard for them. As you said, if you can get away with it for 90 minutes, you can make sure that you don't make any mistakes and not concede. And then you have the chance of turning the ball over and being able to get in behind at their rest defense as well. But you write at the end of this thread, the question is, what is the better solution? Do we accept a boring game that we could lose with bad luck but win 1-0 seven times out of 10? Or is there an approach that is perhaps riskier but has better output overall and is quicker and less of a test of patience? So I'm interested how you would answer that question. Is there an approach that is perhaps riskier but has better output overall and is quicker and less of a test of patience?
I hope so. I haven't tested it on that level, but I have ideas, and I saw certain things, and I am quite optimistic that there are things which are even better. And like, honestly, I think that Guardiola in his very best in the very best moments of his teams, they had many of these things. In their game, and they don't have it completely consistently, but like I think we need to use more dribblings, especially more dribblings in lower positions. We need to use more 2-on-1 at the edge of the opponent's blocks to break down the first line of them and then move diagonally. I think we need to play more into the feet of attacking players and just let them do their thing, basically, which falls into the same category as dribblings. And we need to, I think it's important to have at least a couple of players moving a little bit more freely and trying, like, not waiting in a certain position to get the ball, but trying to do something with their movements and trying to put pressure on the opponent with their movements. I think it's also recently very, very often the best moments of teams come when the opponent loses orientation. You do some movement and the opponent just visually or mentally doesn't pick it up, or doesn't pick it up so much that they defend it 100%. So I think this fluidity and moving into new positions and having like rotations in your team is also a big part which would make positional play better, and which is relatively difficult to integrate because it makes positional play also way more complex. So it's difficult enough to think of as a coach of a structure which is working well, to think of a structure which is completely dynamic and changing every time, and there's movements there and rotations there, and that things become very, very difficult and very complex very fast. So it's relatively difficult to plan, but I think it's the right thing to do. And probably in practice, you will want to have a good mix of concrete structural positional elements in your game, and then certain moments where you leave freedom to your players to figure it out by themselves.
Yeah, lots of really interesting things in there. I mean, the fact that you talk about players who can dribble, I think clearly Guardiola is thinking in the same way as you, because Man City signed a lot of players who are very good dribblers. So I'm thinking Kovacic, Mateus Nunes as well, but also Jeremy Doku in the wide area, who's a very different profile of player to Jack Grealish, right? Jack Grealish being a wide player who you think of in terms of like ability to control the ball, never turns the ball over, wins a huge amount of fouls, whereas Jeremy Doku much more likely to go either way around a fullback. And then the flexibility that you're talking about there in
can I step in there for a second?
Yeah, jump in.
I want to highlight that I think like dribblings from wingers are very widely used and a lot of used. I think dribbling from lower players are not, like Kovacic is more of the example I would think of, or an Ake, for example, when he's going forward with the ball and taking risks there, but like taking risks that you can control, basically, and like dribbling without losing the ball is possible in certain moments, I think, and I think it's a little bit underutilized.
Sure. And then the other example I'm thinking of in terms of positional rotation, stuff we're seeing a lot in Serie A at the moment. So Simone Inzaghi using a lot of flexible rotations with Inter, but also Thiago Motta using certain rotations in build-up as well. So we're clearly seeing those sorts of ideas being implemented in the modern game. But I think the best example of some of the factors that you're talking about here, and one that you mentioned a few times in the thread, is Leverkusen as well. So talk to us a little bit about Leverkusen and what you're seeing from Xabi Alonso, which is working in that direction into finding this more, maybe this more direct version of positional play.
So one of the key things is that they're more compact in the back. The distances between them, especially their seven key players, so they're usually playing like 3-2-4-1, but the 3-2-2. The five of the three center backs, the two number sixes and the two number tens, they are sometimes really, really close together. And they use that to play into pressure more often. So they don't wait for a free player, but they sometimes just basically whenever a player asks for the ball, he gets the ball, no matter if he's free or not. And then because of their small distances, they have better options in counter-pressing. And they have more quick, fast passing options. And also these short passes are faster appearing. And then from this, they are also having a lot of dropping back, moving up, going wide, going inside. So rotations and intuitive like adaptations to the situations. So I think when you think of like how do you defend this perfectly, it's not that much better than other approaches. But the thing is, in practice, you need to have more and quicker defensive actions than other systems. So like in theory, on paper, it's not necessarily better, but in practice, it's just annoying and it tires you mentally because you have to react on so many things so quickly all the time. And against the like more patiently circulating team, which are playing from wing to wing, there's a lot of just like running. You shift to the left, you shift to the right, you shift to the left, you shift to the right. It's also tiring in your legs, but mentally it's relatively easy. It's relatively clear what you've got to do. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one big part of Leverkusen's success.
Sure. And you also talk about extreme overloads as a means of achieving better output without requiring that test of patience as well. So Leverkusen obviously doing that, the ability to get settled possession and then create these really exciting passing sequences through lines of pressure where they overload channels and move the ball through. But obviously that extreme overloading is something that we're seeing across world football, I should say, because a lot of the ideas talked about in the debates about position versus relation that talk about extreme overloading as well. So do you want to talk to us a little bit about your takes on this concept of extreme overloading?
Yeah, we were doing that at Hajduk actually for half a year because I had this in my mind for longer, because one of the issues when you think of the game positionally, you will find yourself in a situation where you cannot, like, you need so many players for protection, you need so many players for width, you need so many players for depth, that the players are automatically so spread or like pinned at the back that it's very difficult to get attacking players in interaction with each other. So to actually have combinations and like quick movements on small space, which we know from like watching experience, if you can get into these situations, they can be very strong, right? So these small space, quick combinations, very strong tool, very difficult to actually do them in a positional play because the distance is also big. So, one of the key ideas was to have, like, in order to avoid the permanent shifting and just that you all the time play wide because you don't have many options, get more options around the ball so you can outplay the opponent on smaller space and also overload the opponent on one side. So the opponent has to shift even more, perhaps more than they can when you really overload a side. Then, like in possession, you can make more overloads than in defense because when you overload in defense, you leave a space open. So if you try to catch an overload of the opponent, a space opens up and the opponent Allen can run into that space and has a dynamic which is usually good for the offense and bad for the defense. That's why I'm thinking this overload, there, like, there are two reasons: one positional reason and one like just football reason, or playing reason, action reason, why these overloads have a lot of potential. But at the same time, you force the game on relatively small spaces. You need to be good in doing that. But at Hajduk, we did this half a year. We were pretty successful with it. Then we changed to a very wide, very positional 4-3-3, very Man City style, and we were also successful with that. But the playing style was very, very different. So I'm not exactly sure what's better, and I tend into the direction of you have to mix them very well, and sure, you have to adapt to the players that you have.
That's interesting. In terms of mixing them, would you advocate sort of mixing it game on game, or would you say half a season you do one, half a season you do the other, just to keep the players interested almost?
Oh, that's interesting. No, I was more thinking of it like positionally, that you have like parts of your game are following a positional logic, and then parts of the game are relational, or like you give them more freedom to move around and find certain moments.
Would you say that's what Xabi Alonso is doing then? Because obviously a lot of the build-up that they use is very positional, and then they get settled possession around the halfway line, and then they're starting to look for those overloads, right?
It's also, I think, Arsenal is doing to a certain degree. They always have this 3-against-3 on the side, and in this 3-against-3, they are pretty free-flowing and try to combine. Sure. So you have this everywhere mixed to some degree, but I think maybe not... Like the perfect formula is probably not there yet. I have a system in mind, but I cannot show you right now, which I think is like the perfect system of football. But this is under this is secret.
You end the thread itself talking about the importance of remembering that football is a game, and I think this is what I'm really interested in right now in terms of tactical development, because to get maybe a little bit nerdy at this point, I'm starting to think about the differences between different types of causality. So when you make a tactical change and it works out, how do we determine why it was good or why it wasn't good? And I think that there's two different things here. One of them is intrinsic causality. So the thing that you're doing in itself is good, and there's a reason why it works. But there's also extrinsic causality as well, which is it works, but there's an external reason to that thing that happens. And
it,
I guess, this is what is
work.
Yeah, sure, right. And it could be any reason, right? It could be maybe if you start playing in with these more extreme overloads, at the moment it works because of the way that everyone else is playing. But after a few years, everyone changes the way they're playing, and then suddenly you realize it's not intrinsically the reason for these overloads working. It's actually the extrinsic reasons of the way that teams are structuring themselves. How much of this do you think is in that balance between intrinsic and extrinsic? And that's obviously what you're talking about when you're talking about the importance of remembering this is a game, and it's some teams will make a change, other teams will respond to it, and we get this dialectic spiraling of everyone responding to each other and weaknesses opening up and that, you know, the trade-offs that make the tactical aspect of football so interesting. Do you think that that's just always the reality of all football? It's always a game, and there's always going to be some solution to the solutions we find in the present day, in the future.
I'm not thinking so. Like, this is one aspect of it. Like, this this is something that you automatically find when you think about it as a game. That you also think, like, in a game, what option do you have? What options does the opponent have? When someone is attacking, how can the others defend? And then what's in theory the best thing to do and such? This is one aspect of it. It's a reoccurring topic for me, because it sounds very trivial, right? It sounds dumb to say that football is a game. Everybody knows that football is a game.
Sure.
But the thing is, we don't tread football like other games are being threaded by the people who discuss these games. When you watch a, let's say, chess broadcast, then the way they talk about the game is so different than from football, and it includes a couple of things. So one of the things is they are not looking for the one best way to play the game. They are just, they know there are different ways to play the game. What is the advantage in this specific situation? And in football, it's very often like very, very dogmatic that you say, this is the way how you play football. So this is the right way, or this is the best way to play football. And there's not even a sense for this strategical for the strategical level of things just have advantages and disadvantages, and you need to like work around that. And it's also the way we discuss player abilities. I think there will be, and there is already a tactical evolution based on that we taught players how to pass around consistently. When you look back 30 years, there were so many players on the pitch who just couldn't pass a ball. They get the ball, they kick it away. They cannot pass it. They cannot control it. And if you have these players on the pitch, you cannot have a positional play. And I think there are many other things like controlling the ball, dribbling, turning with the ball, making quick decisions in certain moments, finding the right moves in certain moments. Many things that can be taught to players which are not talent-based. And we say it's talent-based. We say these are they are talented players, and that's why they are doing it correctly. But the reality, in my opinion, is they are doing it correctly, and that's why we perceive them as talented players to some degree. Like when you are just faster than everybody else, you're faster than everybody else. It's not that talent is not an aspect, but many things that we put on talent is actually teachable, I think. I use in like my favorite football word, which I invented myself, is Spielgeist, which is also the name of my podcast, where I talk about this a little bit, seeing the game as a game. English translation would be playing spirit, or maybe game spirit, as opposed to fighting spirit. So not that fighting spirit is not important, but what I usually say is like fighting spirit is that you are able to survive when you don't know what to do. When you don't have the solution, you're still somewhat okay with the outcome because you fight. Sure. And playing spirit is just finding the right solution. If you don't know the right solution, look for the right solution. And I think these were a couple of examples now how this applies in practice when you discuss football, when we think about football. And I think this is really a very key thing in the development of the game.
Yeah, I guess to borrow a phrase from the gaming world, games having meta, a meta, the way that you play the game. And it sounds to me like Spielgeist is something that plays into that. These are the players who understand how to win the game. And as a result, they're able to thrive in the game.
And also players and coaches who try to evolve the meta, right? This is also a thing in many games, that at some point you have one meta and everybody's playing it like that, and then there's some guy who has a lot of Spielgeist and who finds out, wait, what if we do this? And like, this is also very important for a game.
Well, Martin, it's been absolutely fantastic talking to you. I could have carried on talking for another hour, but logic dictates that podcasts have to be exactly an hour long, and here we are. But it's been so great having you on. It's as I said at the beginning, it's been too long in coming, getting you onto the podcast. For our listeners who want to find out more about what you're doing, you are on Twitter at Martin Raffelt. Obviously, you do stuff through Spiel Verlagerung. You do you run an academy where you put on webinars. You're doing one coming up on Leverkusen as well. People can find out about that on your Twitter feed, I'm sure, as well. And you've mentioned as well, you have a podcast called Spielgeist, which I presume is just available on most podcast aggregators.
It's in German. It's available everywhere, but it's on German. I'm sorry for that.
So everyone will have to learn German so that they can then enjoy your insights in the game. But Martin, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.